As temperatures begin to fall, chances of seeing some of North Florida's most striking birds rise, and the race to see them all begins again. With winter migration underway, we have a special feature from our sister podcast, Coast to Canopy, hosted by Rob Diaz de Villegas, where he talks with a couple of seasoned birders about what to expect at our area's hotspots.
Hey, Rob.
Hey, Gina, how's it going?
Hey, it's going well. So birds are the stars of your latest Coast to Canopy podcast.
Yes, winter birds. It's that season.
Oh, nice. We love the birds.
Yeah.
So you're delving into birding at the St. Mark's Wildlife Refuge. That's just down the road, 45 minutes to an hour or so from us.
Yep.
So has the refuge been impacted by the federal government shutdown?
Oh, absolutely. It's the gates are open from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m., but there are no employees there. The visitor center, the lighthouse, and all that is closed. But, I mean, it's open for birding. It's open for people to go watch monarchs, even if the Monarch Festival isn't happening. There's one bathroom that's open. And I guess the Friends of the St. Mark's Wildlife Refuge really would like people to be careful with their trash there, since there's, you know, they're cleaning up after people. They're emptying trash cans and all that. But just... No one's being paid to empty those trash cans or clean up the bathroom. So just everyone take extra care, I guess, is what they're trying to communicate. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's nice. So is that normal? I mean, for a place like this to be open, even when the government shut down?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. National parks, national wildlife refuges tend to stay open. And sometimes it's a strain on some of these national parks, especially. They get really sometimes get kind of trashed if there aren't people to clean up. And, you know, they can be very large spaces without anyone really supervising them.
Well, it's open, sort of, and you're sharing bird watching tips with us, so let's listen.
It may not feel like it now in North Florida, but winter migration is underway. We're recording this in late September, still over a month away from the peak, but I was looking at the BirdCast migration map just this morning, and the numbers are starting to pick up. The Florida Panhandle is a destination for overwintering birds, and the coming months are a prime time to birdwatch. That is today's topic. Joining us in the studio are Julie DeGrummond. Julie's on the board of directors for the Appalachian Audubon Society, an Audubon chapter serving the area roughly between the Osceola and Apalachicola Rivers and the Florida Panhandle. And you also write blogs for them as well, right?
Yes.
And you're the field trip leader.
Yes.
Yes. All right. Well, welcome, Julie.
Thank you.
Don Morrow volunteers at the St. Mark's National Wildlife Refuge serving shorebirds and ducks. You do the shorebirds twice a month-ish. About once a month for ducks. Yeah. And you also write this great birding report that you can read on the Friends of the Refuge website. Welcome, Don.
Morning.
So I want to start with that bird. So I was just looking at the migration map this morning. It seems like it's really picking up. Do you guys keep an eye on that BirdCast or any of the migration maps? And does that affect like any of your planning of outings? I
check BirdCast every morning just to see what's going on. There are mornings when I'm feeling lazy and I get up and check. Like last week, I got up and 1.7 million birds had crossed Leon County.
Wow.
And it was bolt breakfast and head out the door.
Yeah.
Yep, same here. It's coffee and BirdCast every morning. So, yeah, it's a good predictor. And like Don said, it can change what I'm going to do in a day.
Gotcha. So for our listeners who aren't familiar with it, it's kind of a neat thing. It's the network of weather radars, and they can detect the density of birds. And I mean, 1.7 million birds obviously will show up on a radar. So that's kind of a neat thing. I want to talk about, I guess, I've gone out with both of you on outings at different locations. And so I want to talk, Don, I've been out with you on the refuge, and and Julie, we were out at Lake Jackson at a couple of different spots. So.
Yeah.
So in the coming months, what can we expect at either location? Want to start with Lake Jackson?
Sure. Well, you know, we've been in drought, and so the lake has been steadily dropping.
Yeah.
Lake Jackson is known for the sinkhole that's in it, Porter's Sink. That sink periodically opens up and the lake drains, and when that happens, we get a lot of mud flats. So right now, the lake is looking pretty low, and I'm hopeful we're going to have that event happen again in the next few weeks.
Yeah.
Aside from that, it's always good because there's water there. It's also a great habitat. So around this time of year, we're going to be looking for migrating flycatchers to show up there. Falk Landing is a wonderful location for flycatchers. We've had, we get alder flycatcher every year. Currently, there's one there now. We get least flycatcher sometimes. Last year, I think it was last year, we had a brown crested flycatcher, which is a rarity from the West, very uncommon. Ash-throated flycatcher is another one that can be a visitor that we're on the lookout for. And also, because it has a good mix of habitat with hardwood trees, brushy undergrowth, willows, lake, mudflat. You can just get any variety of birds there, and there are warblers that will be passing through. So I'm looking for those, as well as the birds that are highly associated with the water, like egrets, herons, ducks, shorebirds.
Right. White pelicans show up every once in a while?
They do. I haven't seen any for a while, yeah. But they have been on the lake many times, and, you know, they're in the area.
I guess it was a couple years ago we shot that segment. They were out there in pretty large numbers at that point. I remember that. Yeah,
yes, they were.
So, Don, so I know the refuge gets really busy in the winter. What can we expect in the next couple of months?
Well, right now we are really building up with shorebird migration. Shorebird migration starts very early, with Arctic shorebirds starting to move through as early as July. Right now we've gone from winter, when you have a couple of species of breeding shorebirds and some over-summering yearling shorebirds, the birds that don't migrate in their first year. And you probably have maybe 150, 200 shorebirds on the refuge in early July. Yeah. I did a shorebird survey this week and had over 1,000, 17 different species. So shorebirds are starting to stream through. A lot of these birds are long jumpers. Some of these birds have been flying for several days, may have taken off from North Dakota. They'll land here, species like pectoral sandpiper. They'll feed for a couple of days. They'll bulk up. They'll end up weighing 50 to 75% more than their normal weight, and then they'll take off, and they may land in Suriname. They don't only jump the Gulf of Mexico. They see it as a minor impediment. They keep going until they run out of energy. And we're just starting to get into duck migration. We only have one breeding duck on the refuge, wood duck. They're there year-round, and we get Yankee wood ducks coming down in the winter. But right now we've got blue-winged teal moving through. Blue-winged teal are the odd duck. They're long-distance migrants. Most blue-winged teal are wintering in South America, some as far south as Brazil. And those blue-winged teal are now moving through the refuge. Because they are just stopping and then jumping again, the number of blue-winged teal on the refuge changes every day. I had three yesterday, and I had, I think, 45 2 days before, but it can jump up to a couple of hundred birds, and it can go down to almost nothing. Our big rush of migrant ducks starting to come in will come in and starting in late October, and then in November all the ducks come down. And the duck population will jump from next to nothing, a handful of wood ducks in July, up to several thousand ducks from November through the beginning of February.
And that's a combination of ducks that are stopping and staying, and then also moving on?
Right at the beginning, there are still some ducks that are moving on.
Yeah.
Northern shovelers, a lot of them are going down to the big islands in the Caribbean, Cuba, Hispaniola. But starting in late October, we're getting the ducks that stick. A lot of ducks are only coming down this far. And so we'll end up with 23 species of waterfowl, you know, visible on the refuge over the winter period.
Just for our listeners listening to the podcast, we're talking about a lot of different bird species and bird species that we have footage of. So if you are a visual person, you can check out the video version of this podcast on the WFSU Ecology YouTube channel. And then also we put this podcast on the WFSU Ecology blog, where we'll have photos of these birds as well. So we've talked about specifically so far Lake Jackson and the refuge. As far as the winter months, what are some other kind of cool places we could go within sort of 100 miles of Tallahassee?
Well, there's no shortage of those. Yeah. You know, it just depends on what you're looking for. This time of year, well, as we move into winter, we're going to have sparrows, so we'll be looking at grassy areas as well. Tall Timbers is known for that, and that's kind of a longleaf pine wiregrass habitat there. And the National Forest is another good spot for that. We have a lot of different lakes. So for me, I'm always looking for areas that have water.
Yeah.
Pineezy, Lake Lafayette Heritage Trail is a really great birding spot. You know, if you wanted to travel some, then, you know, there's everything. Well, St. Mark's is always a good place to go. I frequent Bald Point, which is in Franklin County near Alligator Point. That's a fantastic migrant trap there. You'll get a lot of raptors there. So I've had days where I've had like 50 or 60 kestrels and 10, 15 merlins and a couple of peregrine falcons, as well as the warblers and regular residents that are there, shorebirds and such.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned raptors and some of these coastal areas. It's, I think for some people who are listening who might be really getting into birding, like, you know, warblers can be a real challenge and a lot of the smaller birds, but, you know, going out and seeing raptors and wading birds and oyster catchers at Bald Point, especially, that's a lot of fun there and on the oyster reefs. That could be a big obvious thing. You could see that it's a cool looking bird and you get a sense of, you know, birds in the habitat, in a nice, well-preserved habitat. You guys both kind of visit certain spots repeatedly, correct? Mm-hmm. And there's certain spots you have your favorites and you've been going for years. Does that, you think, change you as a person to go to a place over and over again, a natural place, over seasons, over years? I don't know. How does it get you in tune, I guess, with sort of a lot of our rhythms here in the area?
Oh, well, that's definitely true. That's one of the things I love about birding is it is seasonal. And, you know, as the seasons change, we start thinking about what's going to be arriving or what's going to be leaving. And, of course, you look at just how everything ties together, the trees that are losing their leaves or that have berries. Like when I see a good elderberry bunch growing, I think, yeah, I got to remember to check this spot later when those are ripe. And you know that that's going to draw things in. You know, when I see like an insect explosion of some sort, then I'm always thinking, okay, yes, this is great. This is going to bring the birds in. And you just kind of see how all those things mesh together and work together. And, you know, the changes in season means a change in birds, which keeps it fresh and different. And when you go to the same spots over and over again, you get an idea of what's going to happen. You know, just like I mentioned, the alder flycatcher at Falk Landing, every year in September, we get alder flycatcher at Falk Landing. So when I'm thinking about what am I going to see, then I think, okay, I got to go to Falk Landing in September and try and suss out that alder flycatcher.
Yeah.
It's really cool to go to places that you don't normally go to head out to bird someplace that you've never been before. I've been to Alaska looking for birds, and certainly I see things that I will never run into if I just stay in the Big Bend area. But if you bird the same place over and over again, you get a sense for the seasons and how they're changing. It's very common to say there are no seasons in Florida, and that's absolutely not. You know, the seasons are a little bit more subtle. We don't get 12 inches of snow coming down to signal that it's winter, but you can watch how winter comes on and what winter is down here. You know, we all of the naturalists that did famous writings, Thoreau, people like that, all lived in New England, and right. they are New England-centric, and that's what we're taught seasons are. Seasons are colored leaves, snow. Spring happens, you know, at a short period of time, and summer for them is a short period. For us, it's 6 months of the year. Yeah, but it, you know, if you bird the same place over and over, you get a real appreciation and a real sense for how things change slowly and subtly, but continuously.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that about the seasons in Florida. I'm a big native plant person, and also I'm big into insects. I like to watch bees and other things, and you know, at that level, you could definitely see there's almost. Yeah, at that point, 20 different seasons in Florida, the succession of blooms and different insects that emerge at different times. And then when you factor in bird migrations, I know when there's a certain time of year when the hooded mergansers land at a pond by my house. And then that's a thing I mark, you know, as a seasonal mm-hmm. marker of one of the, you know, 20 seasons in Florida. So let's talk a little bit more about the what else is indicative of a Florida winter as far as things that we could see when we're out birding or just in general.
Well, I'll tell you one of my favorites. So the thing I look forward to every winter, this is actually at my house, so it's not a birding hot spot yet, but the hummingbirds.
Oh, yeah.
So growing up, my grandmother actually said to me, take down your hummingbird feeder or the hummingbirds will stay and then they'll die. Because they'll freeze. Mm. And so I grew up believing that you had to take down your hummingbird feeder at, you know, a certain time as fall approached. And that's actually incorrect. So the winter here in Florida is one of the best places for hummingbirds. I get regular rufous hummingbirds and black-chinned hummingbirds that overwinter at my house. I know multiple people that have other birds that are considered rarities here in our area that overwinter with them hummingbird-wise, like buff-bellied hummingbird or calliope hummingbird. And if you don't have your feeders up in the winter, you're not likely to have them. And you might happen upon one passing through, but you're not likely to have them overwinter with you. And that's something that, talking about how you look for the birds to return. So my hummingbirds are banded, and that gives me information that they're the same birds. And just this year on September 12th, I had one of my banded hummingbirds return to my house. It's a female ruby-throated hummingbird, so not one of the rarities. But she spends the winter with me, and the second that bird showed up, I knew it was one of my previous birds because she went to a spot, and she was like, hey, this is my spot, and she started bullying the other hummingbirds, and so immediately I made notice and took pictures of her legs and got the band number and was able to get that information.
Gotcha. The hummingbird migration just sounds kind of impressive. If you think about a bird that size and how far it flies, right? That's pretty cool.
They are Transgulf migrants. Uh-huh. Tiny little, you know, ounce and a half bird is taking off and flying for 600 miles across the water. I can't do that.
Yeah. You mentioned banding, so I want to uh-huh. follow up on that. So talk about that process. So, and I know you do a lot with shorebirds, so you probably see quite a lot of banded birds down there. So explain for people what banding is and how it's done.
Okay. Well, it's done different ways depending on the species of bird. So with the hummingbirds, we actually they have a system where they use a bird cage, and the feeder is put in the bird cage, and we use a rod and reel, essentially, and hold the door open. And when the hummingbird goes in, we close the door. And then the bander takes the bird in the hand, and he takes measurements. He looks at everything from, you know, the molt and growth of feathers, measures the bill, weighs the bird, and puts a tiny little band on its leg. And all of this information is written down and put into databases. Another way that it's done is when birds are chicks. So with like the snail kites that were recently nesting in Leon County, when those baby birds were getting close to fledging age. The banders took the babies out of the nest, did all of those same processes, you know, made measurements and wrote down different markers that they look at, and the bands were put on their legs. And in that case, two of the babies, they actually put GPS tracking devices on, and then they're put back in the nest.
So for a lot, especially for migratory species for banding, like down at the refuge, you get a lot of birds that are flying from different places in the country. So talk about that part of it and the information we get from banding on that end of it as a person who's watching where these birds end up.
Well, you should always be watching for bands. It's a good best practice for birders, and especially with the advent of powerful cameras, you can read the color bands, not necessarily the aluminum band that the Fish and Wildlife Service puts on the bird with a long number on it. That's pretty small. That's hard to see. But a lot of birds will have color bands, and it's with some it's the combination of colors. They're set up so that. You look at the upper right or the upper left or the lower left or the lower right, where the colors are, which colors are on top, which colors are on bottom. And that's a unique combination. With some of the larger birds, I had an American oyster catcher on Lighthouse Pond last week that had a band on both upper legs. And with a lot of birds, they'll have a band. It'll be the same number on each side. And this one had three letters, one above the two. And since they're both the same on each leg, you're looking at it and you can piece together more easily what that is. And I wrote it down, and it was a colored orange band, and I called it into the American Oyster Catcher working group and found out that I had an American Oyster Catcher that was banded at Jacob Riz Park in Queens, New York.
Wow.
On the nest last summer in 2024. It had been found one time before, about a month ago, down in Cedar Key. So that bird had flown down to spend the winter along the Florida coast, dropped in at Cedar Key, and for some reason decided, not so much, and flew up to St. Mark's. Where it goes next, I don't know, but I'll be able to follow it on the American Oyster Catcher webpage.
You can listen to the rest of that conversation on the Coast to Canopy podcast. If you want to see the birds we're talking about, their habitats, and things like bird banding, we have that on the video version of the podcast, which you can find at wfsu.org/ecologyblog or on the WFSU Ecology YouTube channel.
Check out the Speaking of podcast version, available on all platforms.